This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. 76 wealthy nations are now committed to joining a global COVID-19 vaccine allocation plan co-led by the World Health Organization that aims to help buy and fairly distribute the shots. Reuters' Joe Davies tells us Japan, Germany, and Norway are reportedly among them.
That's according to the Gavi Vaccines Alliance, the public-private partnership that is co-leading the initiative with the WHO. Its chief executive, Seth Barclay, told Reuters that it's in talks with China about that country also joining. The plan is called COVAX and is designed to discourage national governments from hoarding vaccines and to focus first on vaccinating the most high-risk people in every country. Its backers say it should lead to lower vaccine costs for everyone and a swifter end to the pandemic. Financing comes out of national budgets and 92 poorer nations are contributing voluntary donations. Participating wealthy countries are also free to procure vaccines through bilateral deals and other plans. The United States has said this week that it won't join COVAX due to the Trump administration's objection to the involvement of the World Health Organization. It's also said the U.S. won't be paying some of the $18 million it owes the World Health Organization as it plans to leave the agency next year.
Reuters' Joe Davies reporting. More than 867,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally, and there are more than 26.2 million confirmed infections. The U.S. continues to lead in both deaths and infections, followed by Brazil, then India. Meanwhile, Indiana University at Bloomington on Thursday urged students living in fraternity and sorority houses to move out, citing an alarming rate of positive COVID-19 tests that marked the latest outbreak in the U.S. Midwest and college campuses. The university said on Twitter that positive tests for coronavirus were exceeding 50% in some Greek houses. This is VOA News. New Zealand's prime minister says the current coronavirus restrictions will remain in place until at least mid-September as a precautionary measure. Authorities had earlier lifted a lockdown in Auckland following an outbreak that began last month, but they continue to limit gathering sizes across the country and mandate that people wear masks on public transport. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, said Friday that as a cautious approach is the best long-term strategy to get the economy open and freedoms back faster in the long term. New Zealand reported 5 new virus cases Friday, 2 among returning travelers already in quarantine, 3 connected to the Auckland outbreak. The Kremlin is rejecting accusations that Russia had been responsible for the poisoning of opposition politician Alexei Navalny and said it saw no grounds for sanctions to impose against Moscow over the case. Reuters, Ed Barron.
The Kremlin was speaking a day after German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Navalny was poisoned with a Soviet-style Novichok nerve agent in an attempt to murder him. Navalny, who's 44, is an outspoken opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin and has specialized in high-impact investigations into official corruption. He collapsed on a domestic Russian flight after drinking a cup of tea that his allies said was poisoned and was airlifted to Germany last week. A Kremlin spokesman said Moscow rejected any suggestion Russia was behind the attack on Navalny and warned other countries against jumping to hasty conclusions. Merkel has said Germany would consult its NATO allies about how to respond to the poisoning.
U.S. President Donald Trump Thursday honed the law and order message he intends to wield against Democratic rival Joe Biden with 2 months to go until Election Day, stepping up attacks that his campaign believes are resonating with background state voters. Speaking at a rally in Pennsylvania, the president told reporters to vote early to make sure the vote counts and be ready to vote in person.
You sign it and send it in, and then you have to follow it. And if on election day or early voting that is not tabulated and counted, you go vote. And then if for some reason after that, it shouldn't take that long, it comes in, they're not going to be able to tabulate it because you will have voted. But you have to make sure your vote counts, because the only way they're going to beat us is by doing that kind of stuff. I'm trying to be nice.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden told residents of Kenosha, Wisconsin, that recent turmoil following the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, can help Americans confront a century of systemic racism. I'm Tommy McNeil.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Ivory Coast President will meet French President Macron in Paris today, Friday.
What we are expecting from President Macron is to talk the language of truth to Mr. Ouattara and tell him that for peace and stability in Cote d'Ivoire, it is better for him to respect the constitution.
Refugee aid groups in Uganda challenge a list showing they lack authorization to operate. Civilians accuse the military of brutality in Cameroon's Anglophone regions. There is a privatization blame game in Zambia, and Ethiopia demands explanation on cutting U.S. aid.
We don't think the U.S. has thought this through carefully, so we consider this some misunderstanding. We are very hopeful that they will reconsider.
And a Nigerian touts herbal COVID-19 treatment that is more potent than Madagascar's. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara will meet with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron in Paris today, Friday. It is suspected the two leaders will discuss Ouattara's controversial decision to seek a third term in the October 31 election, a move that the opposition says is unconstitutional. Mr. Ouattara says his second term was really his first because there were changes made to the 2016 constitution that allow him to run again. The decision has been greeted by violent protest by the opposition. Jean-Gervais Tchaïde is the vice president for finance and budget of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He says he hopes Mr. Macron will tell President Ouattara to respect the Ivorian constitution in the name of peace and stability.
What we are expecting from President Macron is to talk the language of truth to Mr. Ouattara and tell him that for peace and stability in Cote d'Ivoire, it is better for him, not only for his own dignity and his own honor, but also for the stability of the country. It is better for him to respect the constitution and not to run for the third term. It is illegal and it is troublesome.
Do you think Mr. Macron should make it possible so that former President Gbagbo will be allowed to participate?
Yes, this should be able for him to do. Because this is also respecting the constitution of Cote d'Ivoire. Mr. Gbagbo's case is clear. The ICCC has acquitted him. Acquittment means that you have done nothing. So why can he be kept abroad, far from his country, in exile? On top of that, our constitution forbids any ruler of the country from keeping an Ivorian citizen in exile. So the president of France should be able to tell his colleague that Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Blegoudé and even Mr. Soro Guillaume, they should be given the possibility to come back to the country. This is a mere human right.
President Ouattara and President Macron are likely to discuss the crisis in Mali. What role do you think Ivory Coast can play about the situation in Mali?
Now, as a member of the opposition, but also as an Ivorian who has experienced what the Malian people are living now 10 years ago, exactly when the ECOWAS, the African Union, and even the European Union laid embargo on Ivory Coast, as a person who has lived this situation, we expect Cote d'Ivoire as a country, but the Ivorian government to help the Malian people to come out of this crisis. When somebody is in problem, the best thing you can do is to help him, not to impose economic sanctions or social sanctions and increase his suffering. Now, we expect Mr. Macron to help Mali and Africa in general put an end to all those crises, which can be prevented if there is a kind of democratic principles and if France decides to help, not to intervene at any time in their own interest, but in the interest of the two countries.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us. We appreciate it.
You are welcome again.
Jean-Gervais Tchaïde is the vice president for finance and budget of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. Ethiopian officials are demanding an explanation from the United States after it announced this week that it will cut millions of dollars in aid over Ethiopia's decision to begin filling a reservoir at a massive hydropower dam on the Nile River. Egypt and Sudan are opposed to the dam, which they fear could reduce their water supply. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
The U.S. State Department on Wednesday announced it would place a temporary pause on tens of millions of dollars in foreign assistance to Ethiopia in response to authorities there filling a reservoir at the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan have been locked in a bitter dispute over the GERD and the waters of the Nile for nearly a decade. The U.S. entered the fray last year and attempted to broker an agreement, only for Ethiopia to step away from those talks due to suspicions over a bias in Washington towards Egypt. Eyob Tekelin, Ethiopia's state finance minister, told VOA that the government has requested the U.S. provide a full explanation for the aid cut. He also said he believed the situation can be resolved quickly.
We don't think the U.S. has thought this through carefully because the partnership between the U.S. and Ethiopia is solid, very strong, and continues to be. So we consider this some misunderstanding. We don't think this will last. We are very hopeful that they will reconsider because Ethiopia is doing what is absolutely right in all sense of the word, legally, morally as well.
In Washington, talks over whether to cut aid to Ethiopia have been going on for weeks. While some State Department officials opposed the move due to the possible diplomatic fallout, others close to the White House and President Donald Trump pushed to make an example of Ethiopia for starting to fill the reservoir without first getting an agreement with Egypt and Sudan. A State Department official told VOA in a statement that the decision to pause assistance for Ethiopia reflects concerns about Ethiopia's unilateral decision to fill the dam before an agreement and all necessary dam safety measures were in place. The official also stipulated the decision was based on guidance from the president and that cuts would not be made to programs tackling HIV/AIDS, conflict, drought, displacement, and other humanitarian challenges. The cuts will impact programs linked to regional security and could amount to roughly $100 million. Rashid Abdi, a senior analyst on Horn of Africa politics, told VOA that the aid suspension may also be tied to Ethiopia's recent crackdown on opposition leaders and supporters following protests that erupted after the death of the popular Oromo singer Hachilu Hundessa.
There is a growing, I think, discontent with Abiy's leadership style, but also the country's authoritarian drift. So this could be a signal to put basically Abiy on notice and to tell him that, look, our strategic relationship could be damaged if you continue down this path.
The next round of discussions between Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan is scheduled for September 14. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Refugee aid groups in Uganda are crying foul after the government suspended more than 200 of them for non-compliance with rules and permits. A UN special advisor on gender and displacement welcomed the suspensions as a move toward better transparency and regulation. But some activists worry the suspensions could impact 1.4 million refugees who reside in Uganda. Halima Afumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's Minister for Refugees and Disaster Preparedness in mid-August released a list of 208 organizations said to be operating illegally in the country's refugee camps and settlements. According to the letter, these groups lack either permits or memorandums of understanding required to operate. The International Rescue Committee in Uganda was placed under Category 3 of the list, organizations that have valid MOUs but are operating with expired permits. Elijah Okeo, country director of the IRC, says the list was wrong.
Their system was not cleaned. So even, I mean, IRC is there, but we have a valid permit until 2022. So we have already corrected our information in their system. If they run another report, the results would be much more maybe credible.
Action Aid Uganda falls under Category 6 of the minister's list, groups that have neither MOUs nor permits and are therefore not authorized to operate. Henry Ogwal, the Action Aid International Director of Programs and Policy, also says the list was in error.
We signed a new MOU on the 4th of March this year, which means it expires on the 4th of March 2023. So we think that that is an error which should be corrected.
Julius Mchunguzi, the spokesperson for the office of the Prime Minister, says mistakes on the list are easy to fix.
Let them come out publicly to denounce the list. If any NGO, any partner has an issue with that list on where they have been placed, they know the procedure they need to follow to rectify the situation, either to get themselves right or to get themselves off that list.
Victor Ochen, the global advisor to the UN Human Rights Commission for Refugees on Gender, Forced Displacement and Protection, praised the government's move, which he said could reduce overlap between refugee aid groups.
In a way, I'm happy that the government is coming clean about who is working. There's a lot of duplication. There's a lot of pronouncement about invisible work which is happening in the community. I accredit the government on their move to be transparent about their partners on the ground and when it comes to this humanitarian response.
However, activists insist this kind of publication could jeopardize services at a time when the government needs all the help it can get to support refugees in Uganda. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 4. Cameroon's military has detained hundreds of people in the country's troubled northwest as they search for separatists following the killing of a police officer this week. Locals accuse the military of carrying out revenge attacks, including looting and burning shops, a charge that the military denies. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
34-year-old fish seller Ernestine Samo says she has decided to temporarily leave the English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda due to what she says is military brutality. Samo says she was forced out of her shop by armed soldiers who detained 80 other women at a police station for 3 days.
The military entered the whole market and was removing everybody. They break into your store and then started brutalizing you, asking you to go out. They succeeded in removing everybody from the food market to the mobile police station. We were being asked to sit on the ground. Some women were collapsing. The way they terrorized us, we never knew we can come back alive.
Samo says store owners' goods were either looted or torched by the military. Last Monday, the government said separatist fighters in Bamenda killed a policeman in active service. The military was then deployed to hunt for the killers. Residents said troops started arresting people indiscriminately, forcing some either to undress or to sit on the floor for several hours. Scared civilians escaped to neighboring villages and French-speaking towns, including Buda and Bafusam. The government said at least 2 civilians were killed, but did not say if separatists or troops were responsible. General Valenka, the commander of government troops fighting the separatists in the English-speaking northwest region, says the military has not committed any atrocities. He says his troops have remained professional.
Mukar
says his troops fully obey instructions given by the military hierarchy for civilians to be protected and their human rights respected. Mukar says he expects civilians who have been assured of total protection by the military to denounce all suspected separatist fighters in their localities. Rights groups and opposition political parties have condemned the military for what they say are excesses and torture of civilians in handling the crisis. Prince Ekoso, president of the opposition United Socialist Party, says civilians are scared of the military.
These are the things that we have decried for too long. The people of Southwest and Northwest cannot continue to suffer like this. You don't go and punish innocent people for the crime of another person.
Monkey. Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
There is a heated blame game in Zambia over the privatization of state-owned enterprises. Now, Hakainde Hichilema, the leader of the main opposition, UPND, says President Edgar Lungu's government wants to arrest him and later kill him. Edith Nawakwi, former finance minister in the previous government, has alleged that Mr. Hakainde, as chairman of the Zambia Privatization Agency negotiating team, sold government enterprises slated for privatization to himself. The
The government says if the allegations are true, then Mr. Hakainde's conduct is a clear example of corrupt practices. Hakainde, who came second in the 2016 presidential election, says the government wants to arrest him and eliminate him from contesting the 2021 election. UPND spokesperson Charles Kakoma says the party plans to sue Ms. Nawakwe.
From past experience, the only reason they want him in custody is so that they could either poison him or harm him in any way possible. That's why he's suspicious, because he has not committed any criminal offense for them to plan to arrest him. So why should they arrest an innocent person to harm him?
What do you make of the allegations that Mr. Hichilema was in charge of privatization and it benefited him instead of the government?
That's not true. Mr. Hichilema was never in charge of privatization. There were other people that were in charge. The Minister of Finance, who is making those allegations, she was the Minister of Finance, who was in charge of privatization. Mr. Hichilema's consultant's firm, which is an international consultant's firm, Grant Thornton, was given a consultancy to evaluate the assets of one or two companies out of the more companies that were being privatized. And Grant Thornton, where Mr. Hichilema worked, did the evaluations and they gave the reports to government with various options on how to privatize them. And the company where Mr. Hichilema worked was paid some consultation fee, and that was the end of the story. So it is up to government now at that time which went ahead to privatize those companies. Mr. Hichilema was nowhere near.
They claim that Mr. Hichilema had interest when he presided over the sale of the assets.
There was no interest, as I've explained. His job ended at valuing the assets and giving the report to the government to proceed with the sale. So he had no need for a consultant to declare interest because he was not buying any shares. The shares that I say that they were bought by Mr. Hichilema in an intercontinental hotel, one of the five-star hotels in Zambia. The shareholding structure is there, and Mr. Hichilema is not among the shareholders. So he's not a shareholder in Intercontinental Hotel.
So where do we go from here? Is he concerned that the government might prosecute him?
No, it's not prosecution, it's not the fear, but the motives behind the prosecution. So right now, what Hakainde Hichilema has done is to sue the person who was making the allegations, the former finance minister, so that we go to court to prove those allegations he's making. If they have no allegations, then we demand for compensation. That is how we intend to settle the matter.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. A Nigerian biotechnologist says he has an herbal treatment for COVID-19 that is more potent than a popular but unproven tonic made in Madagascar. However, medical authorities caution that plant-based medicines must be tested before use or else they can do more harm than good. Ifeok Itang reports from Jos, Nigeria.
Doctors in Madagascar have touted a herbal drink from the Artemisia plant, an anti-malarial treatment to cure the coronavirus, despite having no scientific proof. The plant, also known as sweet wormwood, contains artemisinin, which has been used in Chinese traditional medicine for centuries to treat fevers. Hope in the plant-based treatment led countries from Tanzania to Liberia to import the brew and develop their own. Innocent Ogbonna, a professor of biotechnology at the University of Jos, says he has created more potent herbal treatments from the plant.
Now, the Artemisia annua in Madagascar has an artemisinin content of 1.1%. Ours has 4.8%. You can see the difference.
As with Madagascar's, Ogbonna's team of researchers claim their herbal cocktails, which are in form of syrups and teas, have helped coronavirus patients to recover. But an infectious disease physician at the Jos University Teaching Hospital, Dr. Nathan Shehu, cautions that testing is needed before using herbs to treat COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus.
It is a fact that herbal remedies are available and could be effective in the management of COVID. But it is important that before they are deployed for such purposes, they should undergo the elaborate trials to validate whether they are functional or not, because this is, you are dealing with human life.
The World Health Organization says 80% of Africans regularly use herbal medicine. But the WHO warns that using unproven remedies can cause more harm than good. Dr. Samuel Gomareb, an infectious disease specialist at a Justician Hospital, emphasizes there is no effective herbal treatment for the virus, let alone a cure.
For now, there is no cure for COVID-19. But in terms of management of patients that are infected with COVID-19, most especially those that have severe symptoms, we understand the disease better than where we started, and then we can better, you know, handle those diseases now.
Until a proven vaccine is found, the Nigerian Center for Disease Control says the best form of prevention is to maintain social distancing, wear a mask, and wash one's hands regularly. Ifeoke Etang for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the news that Nigerian striker Emudeji Ogiebeva has become the first African to clinch the golden boot in the UEFA Women's Champions League following her exploits for Minsk. The 30-year-old netted 10 goals in 7 Champions League outings for Minsk in the 2019-2020 season to share the golden boot. To achieve the feat, Ogiebeva netted 6 goals in the qualifying rounds before adding 4 in the main tournament, despite Minsk, who were eliminated in the round of 16 by Spanish side Barcelona. Staying with Nigeria, 3-time African champions Nigeria have arranged friendly matches against Cote d'Ivoire and Tunisia in Austria next month. Nigerian Football Federation President Amaju Pinnick said the Super Eagles will face Cote d'Ivoire on October the 9th and 4 days later take on Tunisia in another tie. And now to neighbors Ghana, where the second batch of the 70 players invited for Ghana under 20 team will begin camping on Saturday the 4th of September at the Ghanaian Soccer Center of Excellence in Pram-Pram. This exercise will allow head coach Karim Zito and his technical bench to select the final squad and begin preparations for the WAFU 20 qualifiers to be held in Togo. This campaign is coming on the heels of the hint earlier in the week given by Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo on the possible resumption of contact sports, including football, pending the lifting of an imposed ban following the outbreak of COVID-19.
As a known lover of football, I know how devastating its absence has been, and it is my hope that very soon we will all have the pleasure of playing and watching the beautiful game again. Until then, non-contact sports are the only sporting events permitted to take place.
Staying with football news, Sudan national football team will play Tunisia in a friendly before their doubleheader 2021 African Cup of Nations qualifiers in November. The warm-up game against Tunisia will be played on October the 9th at the Hamadi Agribi Olympic Stadium in Raids. Former Commonwealth Games 5,000 meters champion Mercy Chirono is optimistic of getting back to winning laurels for her country as she resumed training in Kenya. The former long-distance champion said it was unfortunate that COVID-19 disrupted her Olympic Games preparations after her planned comeback from maternity leave was further disrupted by the coronavirus pandemic.
We were really focused for the Olympic Games, and it was just unfortunate that the corona came up and disturbed us. Like, it disturbed everything, that all our plans that for even the training, we could not even concentrate more. But now the season has already also started. It has come back, so we are also energetic to move on and focus for the Olympic also next year, and also the cross country.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend.
And that's it for this Friday, September 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.